have this evening the pleasure of Brother Sam Tucker to exhort us, and he's asked that in connection with this subject that we read from Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. I ask your attention now to Brother Sam as he exhorts us on fruit of the Spirit. Brother Sam.
Okay, how's the sound?
Good.
Okay, good. Hopefully it looks good on Zoom as well. Okay, great. All right, good evening. Thanks for coming. It's good to see so many of you. Some new faces, many faces that I've seen a number of times before. Always so good to reconnect. Thanks again to the Henderson Ecclesia for all the work they do year over year. Small but mighty crew, and really appreciate having us to come to, as I know many of you in the audience do as well. So really, really appreciate that. I've really enjoyed the talks and classes this year. I don't know that you're all getting better at giving lectures or giving classes. That might be part of it. I think it's also, I'm just appreciate more the depth and the time and thoughtfulness that has gone into so many of the lessons that have been prepared and shared with us already this week. So I just wanted to say thank you. It's like jumping into a cold pool on a hot day. You know, just it's so refreshing to take time out and be around people and studying, focusing on God's word amidst all the other things that we focus on. And we always wish and hope and think, boy, how do we keep this Bible school energy going when we go back to our daily lives? It's not totally possible, right? I mean, that's a different scenario, different challenges that are put in place. But hopefully it gives us the spiritual energy, and faith and courage and focus on our hope to help us do that. And certainly already for me this week, it has done that. So I appreciate that. I appreciate all of you being here. I appreciate all the young people attending and coming. And it makes it much more enjoyable and fun for all of us to have new life, so to speak. Okay, our topic tonight is the fruit of the Spirit. And Brother Jim just read in Galatians 5, 22 and 23. There's also a quick reference to the fruit of the Spirit in Ephesians 5 and 9, and we'll circle back to that in a little while. I have it written up here in the NIV, but before we get into the fruit of the Spirit, I want to give a little context. This is found in, you know, of course, the main reference here in the letter to the Galatians, Paul's letter to the Galatians. Likely written by Paul, one of his earlier letters, while he was in Ephesus around AD 53 or 54. And to summarize this letter, the gospel message is free and available to all those who embrace it. Jew and Gentile, man, woman, slave, free, all alike. And really importantly in Galatians, probably the most important, unique piece about this. Actually, Brother James talked about this a little bit when he was talking this morning about what makes our Christadelphian truth statement. What is the phrase?
Truth claim.
Thank you. Truth claim unique. And he listed a number of things, but then he said our interpretation of the promises to Abraham and how that applies is really, in his mind at least, the one thing that is likely most unique about our faith or truth claim. Well, so Galatians has that spelled out more clearly, I think, in the New Testament than anywhere else, that the promises to Abraham were always intended to be extended, and they were always intended to be fulfilled through Christ. Christ is that seed. And in the same way, the law of Moses was always intended to be perfected by a better way. And so both of those things, the promises, which the Jews, of course, that would be reading this, would be thinking about, the promises are to us, Abraham is our father, you know, not to the Gentiles. He says, no, the Gentiles are included in that. And then the law of Moses, we must follow the law of Moses. This is going outside the bounds of the law of Moses. He says, no, this is fulfilling the law of Moses. So really important message to the Jews in terms of what they needed to do moving forward, and an equally important message to the Gentiles in these new ecclesias that are founded in Asia Minor, that would have been largely Gentile, that they have this hope, and that this hope is now been extended and opened up to them. So that's the background here. So let's dig into the nine fruits of the Spirit. Okay, love, or agape love. And we'll go into each one of these. Sorry, I meant to mention this. We'll look at the nine fruits of the Spirit. We'll define them. You'll see the words, the Strong's reference, the Greek word up here a couple of times. And then we'll look for each one quickly through three examples of a person in the Bible that exhibited those characteristics. And of course, you're going to think of many other people that exhibited these characteristics, likely some better examples than I have on the screen. That's great. Please, you know, share and use this as an opportunity to dive a little deeper and think to yourself. But we'll look at three examples, and then we'll do some comparing and contrasting with things of darkness or fleshly endeavors. Okay, so love or agape, joy or chara, peace, irene, patience or long-suffering. I've got this in the NIV, by the way, so I've got these words translated the way they are in the NIV, and then in parentheses underneath, that would be the King James Version. Patience, macrothymia, kindness or gentleness, chrysotes, goodness, agathosine, got it, faithfulness or faith, pistis, gentleness or meekness, praetes, and self-control, given as temperance in the King James, but I think we would know this as self-control in today's language, akratia. Okay, so first one, love or agape. I don't often read what's on the slide, but I think I will because I don't know how easy it is to see for everyone. Unconditional sacrificial love that seeks the highest good of others regardless of their response. Agape is a deliberate choice of the will, not driven by feelings or merit. So agape love is given regardless of the response. It's, of course, unconditional that way. But it also might be tough love. It could be, in many conditions, tough love. And it's not the filio, emotional or drawing love. That's a part of it, right? That's a part of agape love. It can be a part of it. But it is really a deliberate choice of will. So who exhibited this? Well, Jesus, not surprisingly, his name might appear more than once tonight, laid down his life for sinners while we were still his enemies. He killed sin, right? We're sinners. He laid down his life while we were still his enemies, the ultimate expression of agape love. And of course, was trying in sacrificing himself to save the very people that were killing him. Ruth, who chose loyalty to Naomi over a return to her homeland, where you go, I will go, a selfless love beyond obligation. Ruth, in most contexts and cultures, you know, she would have felt like, I got cursed for, you know, marrying into this Jewish family. All the men, the providers, have died. Of course, I mean, we would see that the men or the providers made mistakes, and maybe that's why they ended early. But she hung with her mother-in-law, and came back to Jerusalem with, or came back to Israel with no plan, and became essentially a beggar, gleaning through fields and picking up what they could, what she could, to feed herself and her mother-in-law. Joseph, in a very typical story of Jesus, who forgave and provided for his brothers who had sold him into slavery, choosing their welfare over personal grievance. And in fact, the story of Joseph, his faithfulness, I know that's not the trait on the slide right now, was such that he realized when he found out there was a famine in the land and they were coming down, he said, oh, you did this to me out of hatred or to bring about something bad, but God made this happen to save, to preserve much life, I believe is the phrase in the Hebrew. So was able to very quickly recognize and forgive hardship to embrace God's plan. Okay, joy. A deep, abiding gladness rooted in God's presence and promises. Not dependent on outward circumstances. Biblical joy can coexist with suffering because its foundation is eternal. This isn't like I just bit an ice cream cone or won some money, or you know, something that happens and we get high and low, or we get high and we come back down. It's not like that. This is an abiding gladness. It's something that resides deep within us. It is a well of strength for us. Paul and Silas, you know, one of the best examples of this, singing hymns after being imprisoned and beaten, and demonstrating joy that transcended suffering. And if we remember that the disciples at this time were welcoming persecution because they knew it was their work for Christ's sake. Hannah, after years of barrenness and ridicule, praised God with a song of joy at the birth of Samuel. There's a number of songs or psalms of joy and praise to God in the Bible recorded. David has a beautiful one. Hannah, of course, blanking on some other people. Hezekiah, Solomon. But there's a number of these. And when we see that outward expression of joy that's rooted in faith and appreciation for God, it is very inspiring. Of course, Hannah would be faithful as well. But that's not what's on the slide right now. David danced before the ark of the Lord, declaring that in God's presence is fullness of joy. He was a warrior. He was a king. He was the type, you know, there's some types of behaviors that are not appropriate, or not considered appropriate for a man of his position. Yet his joy in God transcended what was appropriate for his role, even to his wife's disappointment in him, but it was she who was punished, not he. Peace, a wholeness and tranquility that surpasses human understanding, rooted in reconciliation with God. Biblical peace, or shalom, encompasses harmony with God, others, and oneself. So it's accepting. It's having, this definition, it almost sounds like a Buddhist sort of thing. It's and we should have that same peace that a Buddhist person might claim to have as well. It's accepting both the negatives in our life and the bumps in the road, but also that we're looking forward to such great joy as was on the previous slide. Jesus, who calmed the storm with a word and offered peace, not as the world gives, inner calm amid outer chaos. Of course, again, beautiful symbolism when Jesus was on the water a couple of times in the boat, and he's showing the world, the storm of the world is nothing compared to the peace of God. Daniel continued praying calmly despite a death sentence in the lion's den, trusting God completely. And I know I think Daniel in the lion's den, I think of the Arch books, and like, there's pretty happy looking lions in there, smiling at Daniel. Yeah, these would have been hungry lions, made intentionally hungry for the purpose of throwing people to their death, right? So, being calm and trusting in God, no matter what happened, that he would be delivered, is an incredible example of inner peace. And Stephen, who it says faced stoning with a face like an angel and forgave his killers with his final breath. Very similar to Jesus' death. Patience, or long-suffering. Long-suffering endurance that bears with difficult people or circumstances without retaliating. The word literally means long-tempered, extending to patience with both God's timing and people's failings. I like this definition. Patience or endurance that bears with difficult people. Anybody have experiences with difficult people in their life? Yeah. Everybody has experiences with difficult people in their life. It also, not just the people, but also the patience with God's timing. Okay, why isn't this happening on my timeline the way I'm doing things right? What's going on? Right? We have to be patient and trusting in God. So Job, who endured catastrophic loss, really all that he had, his family, his health, his wealth, without cursing God, and James gives him as an example and model of steadfast endurance. Abraham waited 25 years for the promised son Isaac, believing God's word over the evidence of his aging body. And it's, you know, we're told that Abraham laughed when he heard this, but if we look at what that means is he was laughing with joy. He was so joyous that God had promised him this. And then, of course, God says, okay, now sacrifice him, you know, when he's 16 or 18 or something like that. And Abraham also had the faithfulness to do what God commanded. And Jesus, when reviled, did not retaliate. When suffering, made no threats, entrusting himself to the Father. Kindness or gentleness, as it's given in the King James Version. Active moral goodness expressed in gracious, gentle actions towards others. Meeting needs with a generous and tender spirit. Kindness is love in action, making itself useful to those in need. So having the love is one thing, and that's very important. It's got to be within us. Showing the love and expressing it to others is also extremely important. Boaz, back to the story of Ruth. Boaz saw Ruth in the field collecting and asked, who is this? Why does she need? Who is she taking care of? Like, he might have recognized, you know, that, you know, and then he found out, oh, she's a Moabitess that's taking care of a Jewish widow that moved back here. So, you know, he told his servants to leave extra grain in the field and then invited her to eat at his table and protected her. Going far beyond the legal minimum. And this ended up both two faithful, kind people doing things for others that ended up married and you know, in the line of Jesus, actually. David and Mephibosheth. You know, David had this really difficult battle with Saul going back and forth. He had Joab that was going out of his way to make things hard by killing people he shouldn't have been killing. He had a lot of advice and counsel to go, hey, you're the new king, it's a different line, wipe it all out, right? Wipe out the other line. That would be the typical man's way of doing things. Well, David was trying to, he was trying to heal and mend the nation. He never, you know, he would never raise his hand against Saul. He waited patiently on God. But then to Saul's offspring and children that were accepting of God's plan, like Mephibosheth, he gave back his lands to him, and he seated him, what it says, permanently at the royal table for the rest of his life. Kindness to somebody that had, you know, that had a tough life in a couple of different ways, right? Being crippled at that time in age would have been very, very difficult, as if we think about, for instance, Jesus' kindness to a number of people that he healed in Jerusalem and other places. And the Good Samaritan bound a wounded stranger's wounds and paid for his lodging. This is Jesus' parable about how to show love to a neighbor. So again, the active outpouring of love to someone to find his kindness. Goodness, moral excellence and integrity that actively does what is right, not merely avoiding evil, but pursuing good. While kindness is gentle, goodness can be bold and even corrective when righteousness demands it. So I like this because it separates a little bit kindness and goodness and the actively doing what's right. It's not just about avoiding sin. I mean, that's a good thing to try to do, of course. But it's also about going beyond that to lean into what you can do that's right. Biblical examples here. Barnabas, called a good man and full of the Holy Spirit, he sold his land for the poor and championed the rejected Paul. When Jesus was preaching, he would tell people, sell all that you have and follow me. And not very many people did it because that's a pretty scary thing to do. I think if you relate that to our lives, you know, you're all in at that point. You know, sell all that you have, all that you know, all that you're attached to, whatever you've done to make your way or path in this world that feels comfortable, just throw that away because that's not the pearl of great price, right? That's useless compared to what I have to offer. I mean, it makes sense when we think about it and apply it to somebody else's life. It's a lot harder when we think about, okay, what would that actually mean to me? And that's something that we should think about and understand as we look at these examples given for us. Jesus in the temple. He drove out the merchants who were exploiting worshipers. Goodness that was bold, righteous, and unafraid of confrontation. Again, he was very rarely do we see an angry Jesus, but we see him a couple of times angry with, you know, the people that were in power entrusted. The people of Israel were entrusted to these people, both naturally because they were doing a lot of the working with the Roman Empire as the leaders of the people. So if they got food or whatever else, like that was important for them, but also spiritually. And they were totally not doing their job. They were stealing from the people, both naturally and spiritually stealing from the people and just making life good for themselves. And this was just an egregious offense. They, you know, turned his father's house into a den of thieves. Right? They were stealing right at the point of when they were supposed to be worshiping God. Nehemiah. Had another class on Nehemiah today. As governor, he refused his food allowance, instead of feeding 150 people from his own resources for 12 years. Nehemiah did a lot of other things that were good as well, but it specifically gives him credit for doing this because it was an unusual thing to do. Faithfulness, or faith, in the King James. Trustworthiness, reliability, and loyalty. Being true to one's word and commitments. The faithful person can be counted on in all circumstances. Here it describes the virtue of steadfast fidelity. So this word pistis, it can mean a couple of different things. You could translate this as faith instead of faithfulness. I chose in this context, I thought faithfulness fit better. Daniel. You know, a man whose enemies could find no corruption or negligence, nothing wrong, completely faithful in all duties over decades of service. Timothy. Paul called him uniquely dependable. I have no one else like him who genuinely cares for your welfare. I can't remember if that was in the letter to the Corinthians or the Philippians or both, but he entrusted that Timothy would do exactly as Paul would do, or better, to these people. And Jonathan, maintained covenant loyalty to David, even at great personal cost, protecting him from King Saul. Talk about an awkward dynamic to be the in line for the kingdom, and your best friend gets anointed instead of your father, and you know it, and you know he's right, and so, you know, Jonathan just immediately put away the worldly things and focused on what was right. The issues that his father had with jealousy, Jonathan did not follow in that footstep. Gentleness, or meekness as it is in the King James. Meekness or humility, power and strength under control. Gentleness is not weakness. It is the deliberate choice to respond with measured grace. Aristotle called it the mean between excessive anger and no anger. Moses, called the most humble man on earth, or the meekest man on earth, yet boldly led millions, confronted Pharaoh, and interceded passionately for Israel. Jesus, again, describes himself as a gentle and humble in heart, entered Jerusalem on a donkey, and of course famously washed his disciples' feet. And Paul compared his manner to a nursing mother, instructed Timothy to gently correct opponents in hope of repentance. And finally, temperance in the King James, or self-control, mastery over one's own desires, appetites, and impulses. The word's root means power within oneself. Self-control governs all the other virtues. Without it, love becomes possessive and joy becomes hedonism. Self-control, one that's so important in our lives, it can be demonstrated in any number of things. I think it's oversaid and overdone, but cell phones. I mean, just the amount that I want to look at my cell phone at random times of day or at awkward moments. That's not unique to kids or adults, or it's everybody. I mean, it's designed to do that, as a matter of fact. So, you know, we have to, with the distractions of this world, that's just one of them. With the things we see in this world, we have to just really be thoughtful and self-control. I mean, that's one, the example for the cell phone. That's not just a religious thing. That's just everybody, you know, the doctors and psychologists and things are saying for mental well-being and health. It's something we have to learn to control. It's a tool. It is not the thing that tells us what to do or controls us. Joseph repeatedly fled Potiphar's wife's advances despite vulnerability, refusing to sin against God. Joseph and David, you know, both say this. And David killed a man, and he says, when he's repenting, he said, you know, he's repenting for sinning against God. I mean, obviously he sinned against his neighbor, right? But more importantly, he sinned against God. Jesus fasted 40 days and resisted worldly temptations when physically exhausted, the pinnacle of self-mastery. And Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the king's rich food and wine, disciplining his body as an act of devotion. Again, the faithfulness, because as it turned out for Daniel, he grew and developed and looked better than all of his counterparts from other countries that did eat the king's food. Okay, so now we're gonna wrap up. Don't get too excited. It's not that quick, but it's not too long either. And we wanna do some compare and contrast, because I gave the examples, the positive examples, people for us. But let's look at in Galatians 5. There was just before the fruit of the Spirit, we find the works of the flesh. So let's go. If you're in Galatians 5, let's read verses 19 through 21. And I'll read this out of the King James, but I think what I have on the screen will be NIV. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of which I tell you before, as I have also told you in times past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. So those are the things to avoid, but as we discussed, it's not good enough just to avoid. You have to then immerse yourself in what comes next, the fruit of the Spirit. Okay, so said in language of our times, sexual immorality, impurity and debauchery, idolatry and witchcraft, hatred and discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions and factions, envy, drunkenness and orgies. Just whatever the flesh can think to do, however you want to react in the moment, somebody made you angry, just let it go. Well, that's not what we're supposed to do. What we are supposed to do are these nine fruits of the Spirit that we just talked about. And for each one of these, works of flesh, there's some combination of the fruits of the Spirit that we should be embracing. Okay, I said at the beginning of the talk that there was there's one place in Ephesians that this was used. So let's go to Ephesians, I think it's just 5 and 9. We'll first just read that verse. It says, "For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth." The fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth. So he references the fruit of the Spirit, and it says it's in all goodness and righteousness and truth. Okay, so Ephesians, the letter to the Ephesians, was likely a circular letter, meaning maybe it was specifically to the Ephesians, maybe not. Most of Paul's letters, they were to a specific ecclesia, and then they have valuable lessons to all the other ecclesias of us today. But we know they were specific to an ecclesia because they would be addressed to people. He'd call out certain people. And then he'd often call out certain problems they were having and say, hey, you got to knock this off and you need to do this instead. In Ephesians, that doesn't happen. And in fact, some of the older manuscripts, they don't even have the two Ephesians in there at the beginning of the chapter, or the book. So it's thought that maybe that was added later. It was found in Ephesus. A circular letter, which I thought was interesting because just the way he refers to the fruit of the Spirit and doesn't define it. He says it's in these three qualities, but he doesn't really define it the way he did in Galatians. It might lead you to believe that he was referring them back to a previous letter. And as we see, this letter was written likely during his first imprisonment in Rome in AD 60 or 62, so 8-ish years after the letter to the Galatians. When he wrote the letter to the Galatians, he was likely in Ephesus. So that's another tie back, some common themes that he would be talking to them about. I thought that was interesting. And here he does something similar to what we had before. Up here we have the works of flesh versus the fruit of the Spirit. Down here we have the contrasting works of darkness to the fruit of the light is what's called. So let's read Ephesians 5, verses 3 through 14. Actually, let's start at verse 1. "Be ye therefore followers of God as dear children, and walk in love, as Christ also hath loved us, and hath given himself for us an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savor. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be once named among you as becometh saints, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks. For this ye know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no man deceive you with vain words, for because of these things cometh the wrath of God upon the children of disobedience. Be not ye therefore partakers with them, for ye were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth, proving what is acceptable unto the Lord. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. For it is a shame even to speak of those things which are done of them in secret. But all things that are reproved are made manifest by the light. For whatsoever doth make manifest is light." Okay, so we have here the works of darkness again contrasting to these fruit of light. And in the same way that we had spirit and flesh contrasted, well, we just have that same symbolism or different symbols, but the same thing, darkness and light. So in closing, walking in the Spirit, I'm going to read Ephesians 5 and 8, since we're in Ephesians. I'll read that again. "For you were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light in the world. Walk as children of the light." If you go to Galatians 5 and 25, just back a few pages, it says, if we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Or, as I have on the screen in the NIV, since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. So it's the way we walk. We know our walk is a symbol of the way we live, the life that we live. These fruits of the Spirit, fleshly desires or darkness desires, all these things are choices. There's ways we live. It's our works. It's what's manifest. It's our walk. And then back to Galatians 5 and 16. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Again, it's a choice to walk in the Spirit. So, as we're living this week together, having great fellowship together, and getting that cold shower from a hot day, so to speak, getting refreshed, let's continue to take these examples and apply them to our lives and recognize that the way we have ultimate satisfaction, ultimate joy, is through our service to God and walking in the Spirit. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Sam. Let us close this evening with the singing of hymn 198.